Mayor, is there anyone signed up for 2433?
Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, March 29th. Before we start our work, please call the roll.
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Representative Smith Warner is excused. Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video. Go Beavs.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. When any Oregon team wins, all Oregon wins. We have basically one topic that today's meeting is devoted to. We'll begin with an informational meeting. Mr. Alanak.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the one topic, Madam, that the Chair is referring to is the economic stimulus payments that the federal government has issued and how that affects Oregon tax liability. There's been a fair amount of confusion on this issue. Oregon does not tax those payments as income. However, having said that, there can be an impact on Oregon taxes depending on the taxpayer. And the mechanism through which that can occur is Oregon's federal tax subtraction. Oregon allows, we have a deduction or subtraction on personal income tax returns for the amount of the taxpayer's federal personal income tax. The stimulus payments were technically, the way Congress created them and implemented them, was they were refundable tax credits. So that directly reduces federal tax liability, which then could have an impact on the federal tax subtraction. That's a limited subtraction. So we have a PowerPoint that Kyle put together, and he's going to walk through this. This is a very detailed discussion of how these two policies interact. So some of the terminology can get a little bit confusing because it's kind of redundant because we're talking about federal income taxes and Oregon income taxes. So I just want to give you a couple seconds to think about the terminology that we're using. We have the federal income tax gets deducted against the state income tax. And there is also a situation where when you file your income tax return and if you itemize your deductions, you can deduct your state taxes against your federal income tax. We refer to this as a cross deductibility. The key piece of information here is the Oregon federal subtraction, and which is affected by federal income taxes. So Kyle has a presentation, so I'm going to hand it off to him, and he's going to walk through that step by step on how a change in the federal income tax liability can affect the Oregon federal tax subtraction.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, I do have an informational slide deck for you related to the federal tax subtraction, as Chris just set that up. So that isn't always in the meeting materials for the meeting. It's not under the bill, so you'll find it there. And I'll go ahead and walk through that. And the idea here is really just to give the committee some background on the Oregon's federal tax subtraction and also how this works and how it interacts with federal tax liability and federal tax changes, hopefully setting up the understanding of how the most recent recovery in the last year or the last 2 years, really, that Chris just alluded to, how those interact with the Oregon tax liability. So with that, I'll go ahead and get my screen shared here. Okay, so again, walking through this, what the goal is today really is to kind of go through what is Oregon's federal tax subtraction, how does that interact with Oregon's personal income tax calculation? I have a conceptual example and then get into some specifics of Oregon's federal tax subtraction, how that interacts with federal tax liability, and then discuss the potential taxpayer outcomes following federal tax changes. So that can include something like the recovery rebate credits, and then get into some specific examples as well for the taxpayers, with hopefully the idea of just really cementing the understanding of how this flows through from a federal change into Oregon's tax system.
And Mr. Easton, I'm going to interrupt here for a moment. I just want to draw Representative Reschke's attention to the logo that's used with the slide number. Okay.
Thumbs up.
You can go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair. And there are some color schemes that hopefully both groups will enjoy later on in the slide deck as well.
Thank you.
But so Oregon's federal tax subtraction, just what is it before we get into some of the details of it? And Chris set this up already, but I'll just reiterate. Taxpayers here in Oregon are allowed a limited subtraction for their current year's federal income tax liability after credits. That's the general structure, the way it's set up. So you have your federal tax liability, and Oregon allows you to subtract that liability potentially here when you file your Oregon income taxes. And for some taxpayers, these changes in at a federal income tax liability can cause then inverse changes here in Oregon tax through the federal tax subtraction. So the general idea here is a federal tax increase can lead to an Oregon tax decrease, whereas a federal tax decrease can lead to an Oregon tax increase. And we'll get into some of the specifics with the examples here in just a little bit. But that's the general idea behind the federal tax subtraction. Again, this is something the committee has seen before in previous orientations, but again, it's that tax calculation flow chart. So in this case, we're talking federal taxable income. That's where Oregon's beginning. We have Oregon additions, Oregon subtractions. So federal taxable income plus additions minus Oregon subtractions equals Oregon taxable income, which then gets applied against the rates. We subtract our Oregon credits, and that ends up with Oregon tax liability. Oh, back the wrong way here. And the key here is the federal tax subtraction shows up as an Oregon subtraction. So a change in that federal tax subtraction can change this amount that you're subtracting from your federal taxable income. So that can influence a taxpayer's Oregon taxable income, which then flows through to potentially changing Oregon tax liability. So focusing in on just this calculation right here and ignoring for now rates and everything, because that's kind of downstream, we can take a conceptual example. Federal taxable income. Let's say the federal taxable income of a taxpayer is $75,000. They have no Oregon additions, so that's plus zero. So again, an Oregon addition is just something that Oregon is, a type of income Oregon is taxing that is not taxable at the federal level. But for this example, that's zero. Minus Oregon subtractions, so assuming this is just the Oregon federal tax subtraction, just for this example, is all is $6,000, so the Oregon taxable income equals $69,000. Now, if we assume there's a tax change at the federal level, where there's a new federal tax credit, let's say there's a new $2,000 federal tax credit, that reduces the taxpayer's tax liability at the federal level, but it reduces their federal tax subtraction by $2,000 here in Oregon, which leads to an Oregon taxable income going up by $2,000. Before it was $69,000, now it's up to $71,000. And that's how then you can see, well, that can lead then potentially to a increase in Oregon tax liability. And again, the takeaway here is it really is an inverse change. So if federal tax subtraction decreases, Oregon taxable income increases. So a decrease at the federal level can lead to an increase here in Oregon. Okay, so getting into some of the details of Oregon's federal tax subtraction. Now, again, there's kind of two things to keep in mind with Oregon's federal tax subtraction related to taxpayers. The first is there's a maximum subtraction amount. So a taxpayer, right now we have the maximum subtraction amount in Oregon is a fixed amount that's then indexed to inflation. So for 2020, it's the $6,950. So if your federal tax liability was $10,000, for Oregon's purposes, Oregon is only going to allow you to subtract that $6,950. So that's the maximum amount. So that's kind of the first thing to keep in mind. The second has to do with the phasing out by adjusted gross income of the federal tax subtraction here in Oregon. So the first step is you could potentially be capped, but then as the taxpayer's income gets above the initial starting point of the phase out or the fully phased out, the federal tax subtraction essentially goes away for that taxpayer. So using a joint filer as an example, the phase out begins at $250,000 in income. By $290,000 in income or more, or AGI, the federal tax subtraction is fully phased out. So that means that taxpayer is no longer deducting or subtracting, when they file their Oregon taxes, any of their federal tax liability. And that's key there, because for someone who is above these fully phased out limits, they don't have anything to subtract. They're not allowed to subtract their federal tax liability. So they're not really affected going forward by any federal changes then in tax liability, because they aren't allowed the subtraction here in Oregon to begin with. And you can see that the charts here are just kind of showing this step-down approach, whether you're a single or a joint filer. It depends upon your AGI, but it's just kind of a different way to view these phase-out amounts of how we phase out the federal tax subtraction. Okay, so if we think about just in terms of scenarios, what are the potential outcomes for this? Well, let's say there's a federal tax cut. You really have kind of two options here. There could be, and generally speaking, there's no Oregon tax change, or the taxpayer has a potential tax liability increases here in Oregon due to the interaction of the federal tax subtraction. Okay, secondly, you could have a federal tax increase that could lead to no Oregon tax change for a taxpayer, or it could lead to an Oregon tax liability decrease. Federal tax increase filters through the federal tax subtraction, could lead to a decrease here in Oregon. So those are kind of the outcomes. There, whether it's a federal tax increase or a federal tax decrease, there's potentially no change to a number of taxpayers. And then other ones, it's going to have that potential inverse relationship. So if we just go into a little bit more conceptually of, okay, what causes this no Oregon tax change as contrasted with a taxpayer that does have an Oregon tax change following a federal tax change? So the first thing for no Oregon tax change, first kind of bucket, if you will, or category to put these taxpayers in, would be a taxpayer who has no federal tax liability. So for a taxpayer at the federal level, who doesn't have federal tax liability, there's nothing for them to subtract when they file their Oregon return to begin with. So if they're already at, say, a zero tax liability at the federal level, or maybe they're getting refundable credits, depending upon, or an income tax credit is a little unique. I'll get to that later in the presentation. But the idea here is if a taxpayer has no federal tax liability, there's nothing for them to subtract using the federal tax subtraction when they file their Oregon taxes. So there's no change following a tax change at the federal level, assuming they stay at that zero liability. So that could be the first bucket is, well, these taxpayers may not be affected. And using the example of the recovery rebates, if they were already at zero tax liability, receiving a recovery rebate wouldn't affect their Oregon tax liability because they're not subtracting anything to begin with. So there really is no change in the federal tax subtraction. Now, the second group has to do with the taxpayer's AGIs above the full phase-out threshold. And I mentioned this earlier, but so if you're a taxpayer who's already fully phased out your federal tax subtraction, again, you have nothing to subtract here in Oregon. There's nothing to be affected from a federal tax change. So again, that's kind of the second bucket of taxpayers that may not be affected. And the third one has to do with that our limit on the federal tax liability or the federal tax subtraction amount. So that amount that is indexed to inflation, for a taxpayer right now, for tax year 2020, the limit was $6,950. So if a taxpayer had federal tax liability of, say, $10,000, and there was a federal tax change that caused their federal tax liability to go down to $9,000, they're still, for Oregon's federal tax subtraction purposes, they're still taking the $6,950, because that's the max subtraction they can. And their federal tax liabilities above that, both before and after the federal tax change. So in this instance, This taxpayer's federal tax subtraction has not changed in Oregon, so that federal tax change, again, didn't lead to any tax changes for them here in Oregon. So there's a federal tax change, no effect on Oregon taxes. So those are kind of the three buckets of a potential no change here in Oregon. For the Oregon tax change, again, this is just, usually you're gonna see an inverse relationship. So if you have a federal tax increase, you're going to see an Oregon tax decrease, federal tax decrease, Oregon tax increase. And that's just kind of the takeaway there for those that have an Oregon tax change. So getting into the weeds just a little bit on a, kind of picking apart these examples a little bit. Here's a conceptual example using the 2020 recovery rebate amount as a change at the federal level and working that through an example to see, well, what occurs here? So the first example that I'll step through here has to do with the taxpayer that is above the Oregon federal tax subtraction limit. The example here would be a single taxpayer. They have an adjusted gross income, or I should say the columns here, that the way this example is set up is you have the pre-recovery rebate and then post-recovery rebate. And then just working down the columns here, one is, I guess, the law before the recovery rebates, one is after the federal recovery rebate law. And in this case, I'm summing both of the recovery rebates from tax year 2020. But you have a taxpayer that might have an AGI in this example of $115,000. Federal tax liability is $17,000. In the first example, it's, okay, their net liability is $17,000, but after the recovery rebate, in this example, the recovery rebate is equal to $1,800. Their net federal tax liability of the recovery rebate goes down to $15,200. So that's the taxpayer's change with the recovery rebate. Their tax liability at the federal level was $17,000. It now becomes $15,200. So if we move into the Oregon calculation, Oregon AGI is $115,000. In this case, we're assuming the example just sets it up. They're an itemized deductor, so they have $13,000 in itemized deductions. And then we get into the federal tax subtraction. Now, again, in this case, before the recovery rebate, this taxpayer has $17,000 in federal tax liability. Well, that's well above the Oregon's maximum amount of the federal tax subtraction you can take, which is $6,950. So because of that, that is what they're subtracting on their Oregon return, is that $6,950 amount, which leaves them with an Oregon taxable income of $95,050. Post-recovery rebates, their federal tax liability did go down by the $1,800 from $17,000 to $15,200. But again, because they're already at that $6,950 cap, there is no change in their federal tax subtraction. They're still well above that limit on their federal tax liability. So in this example, this is an example of a no change. The Oregon taxable income is still $95,050 after the recovery rebate. So this would be the example of a taxpayer that's not affected by those recovery rebates here in Oregon. No tax change. Okay, this next example will be a single filer who is going to be partially affected. So setting up, kind of working through the same structure. Adjusted gross income, $65,000 in this case. Their federal tax liability is $7,200. They also receive a recovery rebate of $1,800. Again, this is a single taxpayer with no children, keeping the calculations fairly simple. The net federal tax liability prior to the recovery rebate was $7,200. After that $1,800 credit, tax liability goes to $5,400. So there's your federal tax reduction. Oregon adjusted gross income is $65,000. They're taking $9,000 in itemized deductions, just an example. Federal tax subtraction, in this case, you'll see a difference. It was $6,950, so it was subject to the cap before, because their tax liability was $7,200, that's more than the $6,950. But post the recovery rebate, again, we saw the federal tax liability drop to $5,400. So the federal tax subtraction is now $5,400. So that's a difference of $1,550. Okay, so what that leads to is in this case, and before the recovery rebate, the Oregon taxable income was $49,050. Post the recovery rebate, Oregon's taxable income for this taxpayer becomes $50,600. So it went up. That Oregon tax change, just using an 8.75% tax rate, about $136. Now, again, there could be credits and all sorts of that offset these, but just to give you some sense of, well, what is that $1,800 recovery rebate yield in terms of the final change in potential Oregon tax? $136 in this example. And again, this is a taxpayer that was above that federal tax subtraction limit. The recovery rebate credit brought them below that limit, down to the $5,400, and that becomes their new federal tax subtraction. So again, this example would be a federal tax decrease leading to increase in Oregon tax liability through the mechanics of the federal tax subtraction. Okay, so the third and final example I have for you here would be looking at a joint taxpayer. And again, I'm using the joint in this example just because it gives them a larger credit, so you can see more of the movement there in the mechanics. But otherwise, it's still the same example, where in this case, the taxpayer's net federal tax liability is assumed to be $6,500 before the recovery rebate. After the recovery rebate, again, this is a joint filer, $3,600 in this case for the recovery rebates, their net federal tax liability decreases from $6,500 to $2,900. So there's your federal tax decrease. Moving through to the Oregon example, or how that flows through to Oregon, federal tax subtraction originally was $6,500. That now drops to $2,900, reflective of the tax reduction at the federal level due to the credit. This leads to a difference then in Oregon taxable income, which was $70,500. It becomes $74,100 because that federal tax subtraction dropped from $6,500 to $2,900. So that difference in this case, the difference in the Oregon taxable income is the full amount of the recovery rebate, because that all flowed right through to their federal tax subtraction. This $3,600 difference could yield about $315 change in tax liability here in Oregon. Again, that's before any potential credits the taxpayer has here in Oregon. But again, that's try to set up the different ways in which, I guess, taxpayers can be affected. I didn't include an example, of course, of a taxpayer that has no federal tax liability, but that would be another no tax change, is a taxpayer that has no federal tax liability, or again, a taxpayer that has their federal tax subtraction fully phased out. But this gives you just a sense of the different magnitudes in which a tax change can occur, especially when you look at these two examples. This taxpayer had the full amount of the recovery rebate flow through and affect their Oregon taxable income, where this taxpayer only had part of it. And so that's why you can kind of have different taxpayers can get these recovery rebates and kind of feel the difference in their Oregon tax liability dependent upon their specific taxpayer situation. Kind of the ramifications of the credit can be greater or lesser depending on the taxpayer and their situation. But so just kind of wrapping up here in terms of, well, what are the things to keep in mind from all this? The first is just changes in federal tax liability can cause changes in Oregon tax liability. Again, it depends. Taxpayers maybe on some of the lower income spectrum may be less likely to have federal tax liability, so therefore they're less likely to be affected. And then those above those fully phased out ranges in Oregon, those higher income, are also less likely to be affected or not affected because they don't have a federal tax subtraction to adjust. Changes in Oregon tax liability depends upon the taxpayer circumstances. Again, it does really depend upon the individual taxpayer and what their tax situation is. Oregon tax liability change is generally inverse to the federal tax liability change. Increase at the federal level, decrease at Oregon. And the last point is just the federal earned income tax credit. Oregon already doesn't take that into account in our federal tax subtraction calculations. So that's a piece that's in statute right now today. But again, those are the general takeaways, hopefully, from this, just to give you a sense of, well, how does this work? How does it interact? And the kind of the goal today was just to really give the members a sense of how these recovery rebates kind of fit into how does this flow through into Oregon's federal tax subtraction, and why does this happen, I guess, in some cases. So hopefully that's what the examples are able to provide as well. But with that, Madam Chair, happy to take any questions, and I apologize for starting the slide deck over there.
That was really very good presentation illustrates the difficulty of trying to say in a quick phrase how this indirect tax impact works in Oregon. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Actually, I just wanted to echo exactly what you said, and thanks staff for putting this together. It's obvious a lot of brain cells went into putting that together, and so thank you.
Committee, are there questions about the presentation, about the mechanics of the subtraction and the impact? If there aren't questions, we can certainly continue covering this later in the meeting.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I am just motivated by Rep. Greschke's university references, as well as Rep. Smith's comment about brain cells, to note that Mr. Easton is a graduate of Southern Oregon University.
Thank you, Rep. Marsh. Representative Greschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Easton, I guess my question is, and maybe you don't have the answer, maybe Mr. Allenack does, that when we heard the revenue forecast back in late February, I think early March, were these calculations built into what we were expecting for revenue, or had this not been considered? As far as whether we are taking action or not taking action on this particular issue.
Okay, I guess I'll jump in here. I think Vice Chair Greschke, this is current law. It's an interaction for the two. So the revenue gain from the tax impact was incorporated into the revenue forecast.
Okay, and then a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And so do we have an estimate what this would then cost the state if we were to move forward with a bill that gave back this addition to Oregon taxpayers?
Well, there, I think, for the 2020, the two payments, and Kyle can jump in here, was about $160 million revenue impact. And for the third round, I think it was around $140 million. Now, the mechanics of what that would cost, we're going to get into some nuances here when we get into the bill. But those are the ballpark estimates that we have, and those were what were incorporated into the revenue forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Allenack, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Chris, have you had a chance to visit with the Oregon Department of Revenue and their team to determine if their GenTech system has the capability to integrate in these adjustments, or is that going to require additional software should we take any type of action?
Representative Smith, I think that's an excellent question. And the Department of Revenue does happen to be signed up on the bill. So when we get to the public hearing, so I don't want to speak for them. They do happen to be in the room. So I think if you don't mind, if we could put that question on hold for a little bit, they can get to that.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Great. Representative Greschke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was mimicking Representative Smith by keeping my hand up in the air, but I'll take it down now. Thank you.
We are done with the informational meeting for now. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2433. And Mr. Allenek, are you going to open this for us and also tell us about an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 2433, as drafted, is a placeholder bill around an LRO study. There is a dash two amendment in OLIS that replaces the bill. And this amendment would create a subtraction for the economic stimulus payments received by taxpayers in 2020 and 2021. And it is for potentially the full amount of the EIP payments, but within all of the, what Kyle just walked through, it's not necessarily the full amount of the EIP payments because it depends on that interaction with the federal tax subtraction. So the examples that Kyle went through, we kind of have the high end of the federal tax subtraction and the low end. And for taxpayers who are affected at the high end, that $69.50, they will get a subtraction that could be less than their economic stimulus payments. It depends on where their federal tax lies. For the other end, the lower income tax filers, even if they have a federal tax liability after credits of less than zero, so they're basically in a refundable position, they would still get a subtraction for their economic stimulus payments. So there's a kind of asymmetry there that comes into play. The language doesn't specify a lot of the mechanics right now. It just says that these adjustments will be made for tax years 2020 and 2021 and leaves open exactly how that would occur. In section four of the bill, it just basically tells the Department of Revenue to implement this policy. So it's kind of open-ended as it currently stands. But I believe that's why they're here to, my guess is that's why they're here to testify.
Thank you for that introduction to the bill and the amendment. The amendment is posted. We have two witnesses signed up to speak, both from the Department of Revenue. Whichever order you would like to go in, Ben and Betsy, please go ahead and whoever wants to go first, just please remember to state your name for the record.
Hi, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Betsy Eimholt. I'm the Director of the Department of Revenue. Happy to be with you today to talk about
Ms. Eimholt,
2433.
Ms. Eimholt, could you wait just a minute?
Well, I missed it right
Betsy,
to it. Thank you,
Betsy. Ms. Eimholt, could you hold on a minute? I'm not hearing you real clearly. It's sort of choppy. Is it the same for other members? Yes. Yeah.
Is it now?
It seems better.
It looks good on my end, so I don't know what I can do. I do have a backup.
Madam Chair, sometimes turning off video can help, if that's okay with you.
Ms. Eimholt, do you mind? We see you. We enjoy seeing your face, but turn off your video because it's using some bandwidth. That may help.
Sure. How's this? Bad? Okay.
Please start again.
Okay. Hi, Madam Chair, Madam Committee. Betsy Eimholt, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm just going to pause and see if this is always working okay. I'm looking for a hand signal from one of you.
It's iffy. Really. It's iffy.
And messages. Ben, if you can hear me, why don't you take it?
And I do want to hear from you. LRO staff, would it work for Ms. Eimholt to hang up this connection and call back in on a phone?
That could probably help, Madam Chair.
Okay.
We're going to give you a few seconds to do that. We'll just, we'll stand at ease for about a half a minute here, giving Ms. Imholt time to hang up and call back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betsy Imholt, Director of the Department of Revenue, and I'm so sorry I'm having bad luck these days with my team. I'm here before you today to talk about House Bill 2433 to address compensating taxpayers for the effects of the federal stimulus payments on the Oregon federal tax subtraction, which you heard about in great detail from that great presentation from Kyle. Before I get into the specifics about how we would handle it, I would just like to take a second to talk about what is happening right now in tax processing at the department, because I think it's an important backdrop for this discussion. We are midway through filing season. Over a million returns have been filed, and we're obviously in our normal processing season, trying to get that work turned around and get refunds back to the folks who they are due to. We're expecting another million to come in between now and the deadline, which has been moved from April 15th, the traditional deadline, out to May 17th. So in 49 days, we're expecting another million returns to come in. About 90% of taxpayers file electronically, mostly through online software providers that are provided by third-party vendors who we work with to make sure all of these changes and updates are implemented from year to year.
There's a lot of it.
But there is a really important change going on right now. And in addition to planning for next season, which we're already doing, we have had to take a pause to undertake a special project to recalculate some tax returns right now in the middle of season to make sure that people are getting a brand new tax break that was included in the American Rescue Plan passed by Congress recently. So this is a targeted tax break for people who got unemployment insurance. But what it means is we have a project that we just launched today where we have over 100 people hand calculating tax returns. It's going to be just under 200,000 returns. And the reason we can do it is because the tax cuts already happened and the size of the group is small enough that we believe that we can accomplish this. We're motivated because we know that these people need their money. And we also wanted to find a way to do this that we didn't have to ask the taxpayer to do something in addition to what they've already done, which is file their tax returns. They've already done what we wanted them to do. We didn't want to ask them to have to do something in addition to that. So we are processing these now. This has taken a lot of IT work because they've had to do a lot of programming and special IT work, but it's also taking a lot of our normal audit staff turning their attention to this hand processing of these returns. So that's going on, and it's going to be going on for several weeks. And it's like everything during times of COVID, it's, yes, unprecedented, and it's definitely outside of our normal work. But it's important as you consider this bill before you today and the amendment to understand that that's happening. So let me transition into this bill specifically and the tax relief that it envisions for a much larger group of taxpayers. So I so much appreciate the flexibility that it gives the department, but I really want to be very upfront with you about what I would foresee us doing with that flexibility and really what would be the most practical way to deliver this tax relief efficiently for everybody that would be due this release. And that is to build this change into the next tax season. And we can do that both for tax year 2020, the current tax year, and 2021. But the very best way to do that is by building it into the next tax season, because then we can put it into the forms, into the instructions. We can work with all of those e-file vendors to make sure it's built in right from the front. And then the correction will automatically calculate, and we don't have to go back and do this whole workaround system. The other option is we could do a workaround system. I would not recommend that. The benefit would be people may get their checks a few months sooner. That would be the reason to do it. Everything else is a huge downside and a huge risk to our 37 tax programs that are all built around a very intricately interwoven schedule that's very dependent on our IT system. And this would be very disruptive to that schedule. So I know that we all have the same goal, which is making sure that the people that are owed money get their money as soon as possible. And we have that too. But I also need to make sure that the systems work that we're responsible for. So it's my recommendation that if you were to move forward, that we would incorporate this into our next filing season. We would have to start on that immediately to do so. Just know that we're your partner, and we want to help you in whatever way you decide that you want to move forward. And please let us know how we can do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you please stay on the line? We have a question, at least a couple of questions for you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but more of a statement. As a person who's been involved in the Department of Revenue budget and management for a number of years, I think there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in what the director has just shared with us. And so I would hope if we did pass this legislation, we would take that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Eimholt, you mentioned that the ARPA changes were about 200,000 returns that you were dealing with manually. What is the universe that this bill would be for the department to handle or to process or reprocess?
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, I believe we're talking closer to 900,000. And LRO, I know, will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's closer to 900,000.
So a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So Ms. Eimholt, you said to do the 200,000, maybe the you're talking about the unemployment insurance tax break, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, that is correct.
Okay, and is that easier to do or harder to do than what's being proposed in House Bill 2433?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, I think that it is easier to do and that it is a more finite group of folks. With this larger population, we would have to go to a fully automated solution, and that's going to take more programming. So we're talking months to make that happen. Our system, we believe, can do it. It's not that, but it's work that's not planned and scoped. So we would have to build all of that into the system before we could start the work. And in the current work situation, because it is smaller, we were able to kind of do a hybrid where we did a little bit of programming and then we did a lot of people. And so we just had a little more flexibility built into that, which would not be an option with the bigger group.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, appreciate that.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Do we have an idea of what the impact is in terms of our revenue situation from making this these changes?
Representative Marsh, so the dollar revenue impact is, the numbers that we're working with so far are $160 million for the 2020 EIP payments, and then about $140 million for this one. So that's a total of about $300 million. And it could be a little bit more than that because of the asymmetry and granting a subtraction at the lower end for the folks who are not affected by the taxation. So a little bit more than that.
Thank you.
Ms. Imholt, one of the things that you mentioned was, I'm paraphrasing slightly, the second option, Plan B, which was not your recommended plan, you said people may get their checks a few months sooner, but I wonder if you could explain to us what that few months is. If we were, and now some of us have already figured this out, but could you please explain it for the public record in a public hearing? If we were to pass a change to tax law, any change to tax law, doesn't go into effect immediately. It goes into effect, I think the correct phrase is something like the 91st day after sine die, after the end of the session. So could you explain what you meant by, even though it's not your preferred route, people could get their checks a few months sooner. What would be the difference? For example, if they were getting checks in April or May, it would help people who are in hardship right now. But when do you think the first checks could go out if we were doing plan?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would have to come back with you with a more realistic timeline. But at a very high level, you're right. The legislation wouldn't go into effect until 90 days after sine die. And that obviously would give us, we wouldn't wait to then until we started our planning. We would be, planning and getting prepared well before then. But if you just look at the timeline, checks wouldn't be going out until the fall or the winter, and filing of course starts in the winter. So that's where I would say that the benefit may include refunds being sent a few months earlier, but we're talking about a pretty narrow window at that point between those. And I don't want to diminish the fact that people, every dollar counts, and I don't want to diminish that. But I also don't want to oversell that this standalone process would deliver something of great difference.
Okay,
I think
thank you.
There could be a difference, yes.
And there's one other thing I'd like to ask you about, and if it's more appropriate to ask the next speaker, just let me know. When you're making the changes now, and that's for unemployment insurance, how easy or hard was it for you to know what the change should be and what the numbers are? And if we were to pass a bill such as this, how easy or hard is it for you to know the right numbers of what someone received in their stimulus payment, for example?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will definitely take you up on punting to Ben Gilley on that math question.
Okay. Okay. We'll save that one for later. Representative Marsh.
I'm sorry, Chair. If you called on me, it's just because I haven't put my hand down.
Oh, okay. Any other questions for Ms. Imholt before I go to the next speaker? And Ms. Imhold, please do stay around if you can. The next witness is Ben Gilley.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Gilley, and I work in our personal income tax program. And so really, I don't know if I have any specific presentation to give you. I was here to augment Director Imhold in her testimony, but I will address the question that you raised, which was the complexity of making this change. So in comparison to the unemployment compensation, the unemployment compensation exclusion can be a little bit more complex because of the fact that it impacts federal adjusted gross income. And there are a number of tax provisions that are based on the federal adjusted gross income. For example, depending on your federal adjusted gross income can determine not only your eligibility for earned income credit, but also the amount that you're entitled to. So there are a number of provisions that interact with federal adjusted gross income. And that's why, as Director Imhold has mentioned, is that we did have to, we couldn't do a complete automated solution for that without, again, taking months to build a system to account for all of those different situations. We saw an opportunity here with the extended due date for us to put some resources, auditors, and other technical staff to be able to take into account all of those potential changes so that we can ensure accurate refunds to taxpayers. And again, we felt like a manual solution, we could respond sooner than if we were to do an automated. Now, with respect to this federal tax subtraction, we do have a lot of that information. Again, it's information that is already reported on their federal return when that is filed along with their state return. But our systems, you know, they are designed to be able to know what all the statutes and rules are ahead of time, and that's what we program for when we bring up what we call a tax filing season. And so anytime we need to make these mid-season changes, then that's where we need to devote quite a bit of resources to make sure that we calculate it correctly. But also things that we need to consider is being able to send the correct explanation to taxpayers so that they know exactly how we calculated their refund. And then we need to be able to give them updated information to be able to give to their preparer next year so they know what the launching pad is for filing their 2021 return. Those are all challenges that come with having a standalone program. We want to make sure we have accuracy. We want transparency to taxpayers. We want to be able to assist tax professionals when they get ready to file their clients' returns next year. And so, and that's why Director Imhold has suggested that the most efficient and probably taxpayer-friendly from a filing standpoint would be to account for it on next year's return as opposed to a standalone system. So I hope that's responded to your question, Chair Nathanson.
Yes, it does. Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm spitballing here a little bit in that I'm just wondering if this law were to, if this bill were to become law 91 days after sine die, what if people were able to file an amended return? Would the department be able to process an amended return with the taxpayer actually doing the work as opposed to the department doing the work so that those that need the money immediately could take action and those who don't need it immediately could wait until 2021 tax filing?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke. That is actually a possibility. So we know that they can't act on it until it becomes law. But once it does become law, then that authorizes software vendors to update their software products. It authorizes us to incorporate that into our processing rules. And so if someone were to file an amended after that date, then we would be within our legal obligation to process that and send them the refund. But again, that does put the responsibility on taxpayers. And there are obviously taxpayers that go to tax professionals for a reason. And then the people who would be using those online services, they would essentially have to wait months after their original filing to go back to, let's say, a software preparer to be able to file an amended return. So there are some software vendors that do support electronic filing, but not all of them. In fact, some of the major ones are in the process of getting that ready for next year, but it's not ready this year. And so that would mean more paper returns being filed into the department. It's less efficient for us, but we would be able to process those returns.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
And thank you, Chair Nathanson. I guess I just want to go back and reiterate what I shared, because we all have different roles we play in this building. The director has shared with us her position, and I guess I'll be more bold than that. The Department of Revenue doesn't have the resources or the staff to undertake an immediate action unless this body's willing to put some serious cash into it. And so I think the director, if I've heard her correctly, has put us on notice of saying she's very concerned about her ability to have her agency that is overworked right now to take on such a project immediately. And if I think I heard her correctly, I also heard that she wants to put us on notice that she's concerned about making sure things get done accurately. And so, I also heard her share that she wants to be a good team player and work with all of us to solve this issue. But I do think we have to be cognizant of the fact that the Department of Revenue is up to its elbows right now. And should we move this legislation forward without taking her thoughts into consideration, we are going to have to make sure we put resources behind it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gilley, another question occurs to me. If some taxpayers chose to file an amended return, and many of those were paper, for example, that will impact your workload as opposed to the normal workload. There may be more paper returns than electronic that you're processing for the batch of amended returns. But beyond that, for someone who chose not to do an amended return because their tax preparer wasn't able to accommodate it or whatever, then what happens? Is there some sort of an adjustment or a claim on the next year's return?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, very good question. So, the previous question from Representative Reschke was, could we do that? And yes, we could. Some of the things that we believe based on our experience is one solution that so that we can ensure consistency and good messaging that with respect to your question, if they were not to take advantage of an amended return this year, then they could, what we would propose is that they would take it as a refundable credit on their next year's return. And that is really the option number one that we're recommending is if we were to have one process, it would be for it to be claimed as a refundable credit on the 2021 return, which is similar to what the IRS is doing with the economic stimulus payments, is for people who didn't receive a payment and should have, then their remedy is to claim it as a refundable credit on their following year's return. And so that's what we would propose in this situation.
Thank you. Committee, are there other questions for Mr. Gilley or Ms. Imholt? I'm not seeing any additional hands right now. Is there anyone else, Mr. Alanak, who had signed up on the witness list before the meeting began?
I don't believe so, Madam Chair. It was just the two witnesses.
Okay. That completes our list of witnesses for the public hearing. Committee, is there anything else you would like to raise or discuss while we're still in this public hearing? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that the Dash 2 looks awful familiar to a bill that is also on our committee, number 3383. So just interesting how they're so similar, but thank you.
I think there is a difference. And I think, do we have that bill yet, Mr. Alanak?
I don't know if it arrived today. It wasn't there the last time I checked. But,
okay.
It's still at the speaker's desk. It was introduced 2 weeks ago. So, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other comments? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2433. Mr. Alanak, any additional comments or observations, information for us before we adjourn?
I don't think so, Madam Chair. That was your agenda for the day.
Anything else from the committee members?
Go Beavs.
I'll second that.
We're adjourned.